Today at the Sunday afternoon talk, somebody asked the question about how can we help ourselves to let go of our attachments to material things. And she was particularly asking, mentioning her attachments to her house and her car. And in a way, it's a very straightforward and simple question, but also it's a question, an issue that's relevant for all of us, you know? As human beings, those who are drawn towards liberation, attracted towards the possibility of freedom of the heart, freeing ourselves from limitation, from all dissatisfaction, then it's a simple question for all of us. You know, what is it that the heart is attached to, and how do we free ourselves from that? So sometimes these are simple material objects. Sometimes the attachments are more towards feelings of independence, or they're to say our role in society, things that are a bit more abstract, attachment to our own mental faculties. But it's essential, really, for all of us to consider, if we aspire towards liberation, what is it that's stopping us from being free? You know, where is the heart attached? What are the things, the qualities of the mental world, the physical world, that the mind, the heart binds itself to, and creates a prison, creates limitation. So for all of us, they're going to be different things. You know, some of us, we might think car. You know, I don't even own a car, so that's not a problem. Got beyond that one. Don't have a house, each one of us, we have our own little or large collection of items, and it's up to us to look and to explore our own attachments to our families, or to our physical well-being, or to our spiritual community, or to Theravada Buddhism, or to our car, our home, the business, or the project that we've developed, over many, many years, or attachment to our achievements, our reputation, for being well known as being a wonderful doctor, or respected as an author, respected as a meditator, you know, one who's a great yogi or supporter of the monasteries, or whatever it might be. Each and every one of us has our own particular variety of areas where we get caught up. Attachments to feelings of superiority or feelings of inferiority, attachments to being critical, you know, the mind caught up in blaming and criticizing, getting annoyed with things. Or if we're a desire type, a greed type, a lobha chariot, then the mind attached to objects of desire, to a desire for other people in terms of sexual desire, or the desire for increased status or greater gains. All of the different kind of varieties of acquisition, things that we feel that we can get, that promise satisfaction and feelings of fulfillment for us. Or even it can be attachment to feelings of self-criticism, fear of being a bad person, or attachment to a negative view of ourselves, and we think, well, why would you want to be attached to a negative view or a feeling of self-criticism? But sometimes that can be harder to give up than material possessions. If we are so strongly identified with the idea that I'm a useless person, I'm no good, I'm a failure, I'm awful, I'm rotten, I'm bad, then it's a mysterious thing. But sometimes even what you would feel to be a terrible imposition or a real burden on the heart, when that's taken away, that's challenged, we can, even with that, we can feel a sense of loss. That even though it's something painful or difficult, is confining us, an unrequited romance or a long-standing feud, conflict. Sometimes the prospect of that ending or finishing can be very distressing to us. I've mentioned a few times over the years how when I first arrived in the monastery in Thailand, in Wat Phananachat, I was very enthusiastic about what I was discovering about Buddhism, about meditation, and this potential for happiness and freedom that was there in the Buddhist path, and particularly in the forest monastic life. And I had this tremendously powerful intuitions of the spiritual potential that was there, by following that was possible through following this path. And one night I had a very vivid dream. And in this dream, it was set in the kind of cowboy movie scenario, and I was in the role of one of the Native Americans, one of the Indians that was attacking a stockade. And the story was that inside this stockade of the white people, inside this fortress, some of my own people, some of my tribe, were locked up, and we were attacking this fortress to try and release our friends, those who'd been captured. And the scene opened just as we'd broken through the gates, and all of the white people had mysteriously sort of disappeared from the scene, or been sort of lying there dramatically with arrows in their chests, like they do in the old cowboy movies. And myself and these others went charging in through the gates with this great feel of exultation and happiness, like, tremendous, marvelous, we've broken the prison open, and we've won, this is great, this is marvelous, how wonderful, how glorious, how delightful. Then I made my way through the sort of corridors and the where the prison cells were inside the stockade, and then it went along, and so looking through the doors, and then saw that one of my friends was locked up in this particular cell. And so I broke the door open, and it was an old school friend, someone I'd grown up with, and was an old buddy, and someone who'd been a closest friend through my teens, and a close associate. But someone who was extremely uninterested in anything spiritual. And so I broke the door open, and he was huddled in the corner of the cell, and I said, "So you're free. We've won the fight, we've won the battle, you're free." And he sort of looked over his shoulder a bit sort of sheepishly and saw me, and then turned back to something that he was doing. So he was facing into the corner of the cell. And so I thought, well, that's funny. He's not sort of jumping up and rejoicing. So I went over and said, Rick, you're free. You can go. And he sort of again looked over his shoulder and said, well, I'm kind of busy. I said, busy? And what are you doing? And then he sort of hunched over and sort of was very attentive to something he was doing with his hands, and I looked over his shoulder, and he was knitting, which wasn't something that he ever did while we were growing up as teenagers. But I said, look, you can finish your knitting later. you don't have to do that here. Look, the door's open. You can go. He said, it's fine. It's fine. I'm okay. I'll just stay here. Thank you. And so I felt this sense of, okay, well, if you want to stay here, that's your business. But well, I'm off. And then I woke up, and it was a very potent and clear message. It was just a few weeks after I had arrived at the place and in Thailand, and I could see that even though I was very enthusiastic and thought this was wonderful and marvelous and the solution to all life's problems, that it was telling me or indicating to me that not all of my old mates and sort of carousing buddies from my childhood and my teens were going to be thinking in the same way. And sure enough, when I got back to England, it was very clear they weren't, most of them, nearly all of them, were not the slightest bit interested. So even when freedom is presented to us, even when the door is open and it's you can walk, it's the possibility of abandoning our limitations and our burdens is open to us. Sometimes we'll hang on to them. Because they're what we know. They're, as they say in the English expression, they're the devil that we know. And better the devil that you know than the devil that you don't know. And so it's ironic and tragic how often we, even when the things are painful and burdensome to us, we'll still remain attached to them because they're the devil that we know. And even though just putting them down and letting go could genuinely free the heart and bring a much more profound and complete happiness, we still hang on to them and carry them around and try to cherish them and keep them and maintain them in being, because that's what we know. That's the devil that we know. It's what's familiar to us and gives us, even if painfully, it gives us a sense of identity, a sense of who we are, a sense of being. And that's what comforts us, even though that, as the Buddha says, what we relish brings fear, and what we fear is pain. You know, still, we in this mysterious and strange, very ironic way, we still hang on to the things that cause us pain and tension and alienation. So in considering this and talking about how we can, what are the most accessible tools for letting go of our attachments, then what I find is for myself is the most helpful, direct and effective approach is to develop the reflective mind, the mind that, say, picks up that perception and questions it. And so in particular, the advice of Lumpo Cha in considering what, particularly with material possessions, but it also works with other things in our life, mental things or more abstract attachments, to consider, say, you know, if you're attached to a car, this is a broken car. This is the car is already broken. The car is already stolen. Or the house, you know, the house is already fallen down. You know, the house is already lost to us. The house has already been sold or taken away. And this derives from his most common example of picking up a glass like this and saying, you know, this glass is already broken. And that if we can see that the glass is already broken, and that that's its true state, is it's a pattern of nature in a constant state of change, even though that at present there's no problem with it holding water, there's no visible crack in it, and what that statement saying that the glass is already broken is to say that you're recognizing the intrinsic transiency of it, the intrinsic quality of it as being unstable and of a changing nature. And if we see that the glass is already broken, then when the day comes and it actually gets knocked over and cracked or it smashes, then we're not surprised and our heart doesn't break with the glass. Our heart is not broken along with it because we've already prepared ourselves for that. We know, oh, this is in a state of change. It's already broken. It just hasn't reached its day of fulfilling that particular state. But it's on its way. You know, sooner or later, at some point or other, that this glass is definitely broken. Now, this takes an effort to rise up. It takes an engagement and to bring that reflective attitude towards it. We need to rouse that because our assumption is, well, the glass isn't broken yet. I can use it, and it's a good glass, and I don't need to think about it. So our habit, the way that we generally see our bodies and our possessions and the community that we're a part of, or the work that we do, the family that we're a part of, the institutions that we belong to or we're affected by, we just assume that they are there. This temple is here. It's a solid building. It's supposed to be here for 1,000 years. This is a good glass. This is a good solid oak Dhamma seat. You know, these things are here. They're solid. They're real. They are dependable. So it takes effort to rouse the mind that sees anicca, sees impermanence, sees uncertainty. That takes an effort and an engagement, because the superficial perception is one of permanence, of solidity, of firmness. But if we don't just go along with those simple habits of perception, and instead, see, oh, this building has come together. 15 years ago, this was the site of the old school gymnasium and the original Amravati Dhamma Hall. And before that, 80 years ago, this was a field on Farmer Blaine's father's property before the government compulsorily purchased it and turned it into a summer camp, and then had other subsequent incarnations as a place for evacuee children from London, and then turned into a school, and then now turned into Amaravati Monastery. But coming into this temple, it feels like it's here, it's solid, it's real, it's permanent, it's definitely a dependable thing. It is the temple. It is the center of the spiritual community here at Amaravati. This is our main meeting place, and the spiritual heart of the community is formed around this space. But if we're wise, we'll see, well, this is a broken building. This is a collapsed building. This is a burnt down building. This is in a state of change. This Dhamma seat, this solid oak, very firmly built Dhamma seat, is in a state of change. It's not something that's intrinsically solid and permanent. And that with this simple reflection, even though it takes effort to apply it, it doesn't take a lot of effort, but it does take a certain amount of recollecting, of bringing the attention to that and training ourselves to see in this way, seeing the material objects, the things that we possess or are dear to us, our favorite clock or our favorite pen or our simple possessions like that, or our car or our home, to be recognizing this is a lost pen, this is a broken clock, this is an ex-car, this is a collapsed building, this is an ex-Dhamma seat, this is future firewood. Then that small amount of effort that's required to bring that recollection to mind, even if there's a resistance to that, like, well, not really, I mean, come on, I don't want that to be true. Well, that's not really the case. If you're careful, you can keep it for a long time. And just seeing that resistance in the mind that doesn't want to know that or doesn't want to recognize that, seeing that, say, contention against that actuality right there, Right there in that, what we're witnessing is the heart's attachment, the identification that this is mine, this is something that belongs to me, it is a real thing, and I am the owner. Or as it says in the Anatta Lakkhana Sutta, you know, this is mine, etang mama. This is mine. I am the owner of this. This is the a thing that is truly and absolutely possessed by me. So this is a simple practice, but it's remarkably effective. It has an extraordinary power, just to bring to mind the quality of anicca, to develop the anicca sanya, to bring this to. Not just to the things that are precious to us or that are obviously objects that we own, but to develop this as a lens through which we see our whole life. We see our material form, our body, our possessions, but also our mind states, our faculties of seeing and hearing, smelling, tasting, touching. To be ready to see the quality of anicca, impermanence, uncertainty in the aspects of the world around us. This is an extraordinarily helpful and potent way of breaking through the habits of identification and attachment, and where the heart is continually trying to take root in making a world of self, of certainty, of permanence, yeah. Of Nietzsche Sukha Atta, of permanence, of happiness, and self. That there is the mind is continually trying to establish those in our mind, our body, and the things around us. That it keeps trying to find Sukha, Nietzsche, and Atta. It keeps trying to find self, and happiness, and permanence, reliability. In the realm of form, in the realm of the material world, and also in our mind, in the realm of perception, and in the realm of memory and thought and emotion and mood. And the reason why we keep feeling, insecure or threatened or unhappy or alienated, those feelings, different kinds of dukkha, is because we keep looking for security in that which is intrinsically insecure. We keep looking for certainty in that which cannot be certain. We keep looking for solidity and permanence and reliability in that which cannot be reliable. And again, this is the kind of point that Lumpu Cha would make over and over again. And it's a simple insight, but it's so helpful if we actually apply it. We bring it to life in our moment-to-moment experience, that if you're looking for security in that which is insecure, you have to be disappointed. You're bound to be disappointed. We will necessarily be frustrated or feel let down, because we're looking for a rabbit with horns. We're looking, as they would say in Thailand, for a turtle with a moustache. You're looking for an animal that just does not exist. So you necessarily will be disappointed that, no matter how hard I hunt, I'm never going to find a rabbit with horns. I'm never going to find a turtle with a moustache. And that search is bound to end up in disappointment, in frustration, in the feelings of incompleteness. So to develop this perception of uncertainty is also... it takes effort, but it's not it doesn't take a huge amount of effort, but it's, I say, a recollection that's extraordinarily effective. If we do apply it, if we really bring it to life, then it changes the way that we hold our material possessions, the way that we relate to ownership, the way we relate to our own body, the way we relate to the people around us, the way we relate to the world around us. And so that then, as things demonstrate that changeability and unreliability, rather than the feeling that something's gone wrong, or that because we were healthy and now we're sick, or that we had something and now that it's changed on us, rather than thinking something's gone wrong or something that we had owned has now been lost, we instead recognize, oh yeah, well, this is the truth of anicca, the truth of uncertainty, of transiency that's being demonstrated. This was the truth all along. Nothing's been lost. Nothing has betrayed us or let us down. It's just it was always this way, and now it's just demonstrating that the fact that it never really was ours. This quality of change, again, is an extraordinarily simple insight. But in the, say, in the Dhammacakka Sutta that we were chanting this evening, that it describes how when the Buddha gives the teaching on the middle way and the Four Noble Truths, then Kandanya, one of the five ascetics, his companions who hears this, then he is the first one to understand the implications of that teaching, the Buddha's explanation of this insight, this framework of insight of the Four Noble Truths. And Kandanya understands the implication of that. And then he sees, oh, this is true, and this is the path. What this great monk, our former companion and guide, has said, this is actually true, this is real, this is what points the way. Aha, this is it. And when he sees this is it, this is the path, the way that takes shape in his mind is in the insight, yang kinchi samudaya dhammang sabantang nirodha dhammanti. Whatever is subject to arising is subject to cessation. So again, it doesn't seem like very much. And this is a theme of Dhamma that's pointed out over and over again. And it's easy to for the mind go, oh yeah, anicca, yeah, I know this. Oh, this is familiar. Okay, I can switch off and just kind of shut that out. This is all familiar territory to me. But if it was really familiar, if we really knew that all that is subject to arising is subject to cessation, then our heart would already have made the breakthrough to stream entry, would already be, irreversibly bound to enlightenment, to complete liberation. If we really saw, if we really knew, if the heart was really aware that everything that is subject to arising is subject to cessation, because that's the turning point, the spiritual turning point, is to really acknowledge or to fully know, to fully apprehend the implications of that simple truth. You know, in terms of factual knowledge, it's a fact or an aspect of nature that a 3-year-old can understand. What goes up must come down. All that begins ends. If it starts, it has to stop. You know, a 3-year-old, a 4-year-old can understand that and cognize what it means. So the intellectual fact of it is nothing elaborate, or nothing complicated, nothing difficult to comprehend, to understand. But it's the implications of that make the difference. That if we really allow that truth to soak into the heart, then it changes the whole way that the world is experienced. It changes the way that this mind, this body, and the world around us is experienced and known. It creates an irreversible shift in view. It's the establishment of right view in an irreversible way, so that once that has truly been seen, then you can't unsee it. It can't be unseen. Like once you've learned to ride a bicycle, you can't unlearn it. Once you've solved the puzzle, you can't unsolve it. You always will remember how the puzzle is solved. You know, you've seen it. You know how the trick is done. So you can't unlearn that. You can't unknow it. One of the aspects of this, why we it's so crucial, is that the insight into uncertainty, it has a direct effect on our say, self-image, the way the mind creates a sense of self. That once the mind truly recognizes uncertainty, the truth of anicca, then the habits of self-view, of sakkaya ditti, are undermined. That if everything is uncertain, then the perception of who and what we are is one of those things that's uncertain. That we are constantly, the mind is constantly trying to create and maintain an image of me, what I am, who I am. I am this as this independent, individual, separate person who is male, who is female, who is old, who is young, who is like this or like that. The mind is constantly generating and trying to sustain a consistent self-image, tries to create self-view and to hold that in place and to maintain it as a solid, separate, distinct reality. But as soon as we really entertain and apprehend the truth of uncertainty, of anicca, then that pulls the plug on self-view, doesn't it? That's not the whole story, or that's just a convenient fiction, or that's just a set of habitual perceptions, but it's not the ultimate truth of things. It can't be. It can't be the whole story. That's not truly who and what we are. Again, as it says in the Anatta Lakkhana Sutta, and the Buddha goes through that analysis of the body and the mind, with the physical form, our body, rupa. This is to see that, this is not me, this is not mine, this is not myself. The feelings, perceptions, mental formations, consciousness itself, to see, piece by piece, each aspect of the body, of the mind, the material world. Ne tang mama, ne so hamasmi, ne so me ata. When it's really looked at and explored and examined, it's recognized, this is not me, this is not mine, this is not myself. It's changing, it's transient, it's unstable. It can't be permanently satisfying. It can't be who and what we are. It can't be the ultimate truth of what is. It can't be. So that truth of the quality of anicca, of transiency, of emptiness, uncertainty, one of its chief attributes then is like puncturing, like it's like popping the balloon or the bubble of self-view with a with a little pin or a finger that pops that particular floating bubble of I and me and mine, and that seeing through self-view, dropping self-view, or recognizing that the perceptions and the images that we have of who and what we are, they can only be half-truths or convenient fictions. That is part of the establishment of right view, part of the establishment of the heart on the path to the realization of Dhamma. It's like the first element of entering the stream is seeing through self-view and seeing that incomplete and partial qualities of any kind of self-image, of identifying who and what we are through the body or through our thoughts or feelings, emotions, memories, ideas. The most recent book of Lumpo Samato's teachings put out by the Buddhist publishing group is called Don't Take Your Life Personally, which I think just the title of the book pretty much tells you everything. Tells you everything that's in the book. The whole message is right there. Don't take your life personally. Because on the one hand, conventionally speaking, we call it our life. But then we see that the problems come from taking it personally, and that we so easily identify with these aspects of the body, the personality, and then also the things that happen in our life, the things that we do, and the choices that we make, that we take it all very, very personally. We make it all something that's, say, solid and real and who and what we are. But through this development of the perception of anicca, the perception of uncertainty, and then, say, developing the insight into not-self, learning to let go of sakkaya ditti, then we begin to see that it's, you know, our life, who and what we are, is really a sort of complex and intricate blend of, you know, patterns of nature, and that function according to natural laws, and that we make a huge deal, we make a big deal out of our age, our gender, our past history, the stories of our life, our successes, our failures, the things that we like, the things that we don't like, the things that work, the things that don't work, the things that we approve of, the things that we disapprove of. We gather all of these different aspects of nature together, and then we call them me, we call them mine, of our body, our personality, our memories, lists of achievements and successes and failures. In that simple statement of Lumpur's, like, don't take your life personally, it's a very, very helpful injunction. It's a very helpful piece of advice, because when there's a quality of wisdom, when we take, in a sense, take a step back from our life and look at it through the eye of wisdom, when we say, examine what we think of as our life, we can see that it's really just a large collection of natural processes, all functioning according to laws of nature. And today, with the Sunday afternoon talk, the theme was on who is pulling the strings. Yeah? And it was somewhat about karma and how we can have the idea that there are forces of nature beings or things that are controlling our life or pulling the strings of making things go well or making things go badly or steering us in particular directions or making things happen in fixed and determined ways. And that one of the things that is important to consider in terms of our lives and how we create a lot of tension or sense of alienation or insecurities within ourselves is that we strongly identify with our actions, and that the things that happen in our life. And we look at things in terms of what we like, what we don't like, what we approve of, what we don't approve of. But in the Buddha's reflections on developing the four Brahma Viharas, you know, you'll notice that when we're looking at the verse to encourage loving kindness, is may I abide in well-being, may everyone abide in well-being. That's fairly straightforward. The encouragement or the development of compassion is may all beings be released from all suffering. Very straightforward. For mudita, for sympathetic joy, may all beings not be parted from the good fortune they have attained. So again, very straightforward. But the development of upekha or equanimity, serenity, is a reflection on karma, isn't it? So that then the tone changes when we get to that fourth element of the Brahma Viharas. It's after that, the reflection on mudita, may all beings not be parted from the good fortune they've attained. Then for upekha, it steers us towards reflecting on karma. What brings equanimity is to recognize I'm the owner of my karma, heir to my karma, born of my karma, related to my karma, abide supported by my karma. Whatever karma I shall do, for good or for ill, of that I will be the heir. So, what it's encouraging is just seeing that the sheer natural cause and effect nature of what we experience, that the patterns of things that happen in our life, that if we are unkind or if we're greedy or selfish, then it'll have we'll have a painful memory. If we do good and if we're kind and generous, then there'll be a pleasant memory. If we're honest and friendly and respectful towards others, when we see them, they'll smile at us. If we're grumpy and critical and aggressive, when they see us, they'll frown or they'll avoid us. It's not rocket science, as they say. We are the heirs of our karma, owners of our karma, related to our karma. So when we look at our life in this way, and we say, take a step back and see how what is being witnessed is just the simple laws of cause and effect. This is the cause, that's the effect. You know, if you're kindly, then there's this effect. If you're aggressive, then there's this effect. This is the cause, this is the result. This is the cause, this is the result. Then when we see that that simple, natural relationship, just in terms of our actions, then the result of that is equanimity. There's an evenness of heart. It's like, well, why get upset? It's just the laws of nature operating. It's like getting upset with the law of gravity, or, you know, getting upset with the changing patterns of day and night, or like now with this is the changing of the season. The autumnal equinox has come around. Today's September 23rd, so summer is over, the autumn has just begun, the equinox has just come by, so it's very commonly a time when the weather changes. So we've had quite beautiful, benign weather, clear and bright, and then today is grey and rainy, and the weather's changed. So to get upset with the weather is just like... whether we get upset or not, you know, the rain is still coming down. Whether we think it should or shouldn't be there, it's totally irrelevant. The rain just comes down because this is the configuration of the weather systems. They're doing this right now. This is how they work. It's just the natural order functioning. And so when we relate to it in that way, we realize, well, getting upset about it or annoyed is just our own problem, that it's the weather is just being the weather. It's not personally attacking us, or there's not these sort of spirits up in the skies who are looking to find ways to mess up our days. It's just the weather doing its thing, and to recognize that, to see, if there's a problem here, it's only coming from one place. It's only coming from us. If the weather is problematic, that problematicness, if such a word exists, is coming from me. It's not coming from anywhere else. It's not coming from the weather. So when we similarly look at our lives and the events of our lives, then, and we consider this cause and effect nature of our experience, then there's an evenness of heart, there's a coolness, a steadiness, there's an easefulness that we can tap into that is extraordinarily peaceful and beautiful. So this is the result of not taking our life personally, is a quality of upeka, a coolness, an easiness, an easefulness, that when we take that step. It's also helpful to consider that along with being the owners of our actions, of what we experience in this moment, and again, this is something I brought up in the talk today that I feel is very helpful to consider. Oftentimes, it gets presented that the entirety of what we are experiencing in this moment is the result of past karma, like actions that we have personally taken in a previous life or in this life. But the Buddha didn't put things in that way, but he said rather that experience of vipaka, the resultant karma, is one element of what causes the entirety of what we're experiencing right now. but also contributing to the pattern of what we're experiencing, are the other laws of nature, like the laws of physics and chemistry, like the weight of our body on the cushion or on the chair. You know, that is not a person. That's nothing to do with your personal actions. I mean, nobody here invented the law of gravity, right? I was not personally involved in establishing how gravity works. You know, none of us here were in a discussion to choose the weight of the proton and the neutron, or the charge on the electron. These are not personal choices that we were a part of, but we experience them. Or the aerobic respiration, the body breathing oxygen, is something that's essential to all of us. And it's a crucial part of our lives. If any one of us stopped breathing for 5 minutes, we'd be dead. So breathing is really, really important. But because we're all experiencing it all the time, it's not anything that's worthy of attention. But the fact that we have human bodies, we're a part of the living world that relies on aerobic respiration, we need oxygen to stay alive, then that's very much a part of our lives. If the oxygen was denied to us, then we'd keel over and die. And so that's very much a part of our life. But we don't think about that, do we? Because it's not something that varies between us. It doesn't vary from day to day. But it's pretty much the same wherever we go, at least at this altitude on this planet. The oxygen is here. So it's unremarkable. But these simple laws and aspects of nature, the biological world, the physical world, these are very much a part of our life, how we experience things. Also the laws of how the mind works, the citta niyama. So the first two are utu niyama, the laws of physics and chemistry. Utu literally means weather. Then the bija niyama, the laws of biology, the laws of the living world, how living systems function. And kama niyama is the third. Then jitta niyama is the fourth. The laws of psychology, how we perceive things, how the systems of hearing, seeing, smelling, tasting, touching, how they function, how memory works, how thought works, how emotions work, how instincts work, the functioning of the mental realm. This is all jitta niyama. And then the fifth one, the sort of overarching framework for the whole system, is Dhamma Niyama, the relation within that of the conditioned and the unconditioned, the timeless and the time-bound, the born and dying, and the birthless, the deathless. So in any one moment, all these five laws, these five patterns are contributing to what we experience here and now, sitting here in the temple, feeling the weight of the body, hearing these words. This experience is woven together out of all these different elements. So we experience these here and now, and this makes up how life feels to us as individuals that we're conscious of. But all of those elements are not self. And it's easier to see things like the laws of physics and chemistry and biology, or the functioning of the mental faculties are not self, but also the elements of karma and vipaka, that these are also not self. The choices that are made, the results of those choices that are made, these are also not self. They're not who and what we are. So when we consider, when we reflect on the whole experience of the present moment, it's not just the results of personal actions, but we are the inheritors of and the experiences. We participate in the whole natural order, the physical and mental world. But none of it is personal. None of it is who and what we are. It's felt here within the awareness of our own minds, of these lives, but if those minds see clearly, if there is wisdom and clarity, then none of this is taken as personal. It's just where the heart is able to recognize all the different elements of it as simply patterns of nature, organic patterns of change coming and going in a fluid and orderly way. This is called the Dhamma Niyamata, the lawfulness of Dhamma, or the lawfulness of the natural order. And when the heart really recognizes, when there's a true quality of satipanya, mindfulness and wisdom, then that lawfulness, that Dhamma Niyamata, is recognized. And when that is recognized, then there's an ending of dukkha. Nothing is seen or felt as being out of place. Nothing is seen or felt as being as though it should not be. There's some kind of wrongness. What was felt or is experienced might be painful, or might be unlikable, but it doesn't have that quality of wrongness added onto it. It doesn't have that quality of should not be. It doesn't have the quality of this does not belong, because that awakening of the heart to that lawfulness of the Dhamma, the Dhamma Niyamata, recognizes it all belongs, that the pleasant and the painful. How could anything not be a part of the natural order? How could any aspect of what is experienced and known not be part of the Dhamma itself, the whole natural order of things? So that even though it might be a painful or a difficult, challenging emotion or physical sensation, a challenging situation, the heart can still be in full accord with that. Or maybe the last thing to consider or to reflect in this, and how we can look at karma vipaka, action and its results. And we can get very fixed on the idea of how if this is the cause, this is the effect, and when we take this. This kind of principle, I'm the owner of my karma, heir to my karma, born of my karma, related to my karma. We can take hold of that and unwittingly, in a mistaken way, turn that into an identity and make it, if we grasp that principle in a wrong way, so we can turn it into we can in a way feed the self-view with that idea. I'm the owner of my karma, I'm born of my karma, that's what I am, this is me, this is my karma, this is who and what I am. But this is not what the Buddha is intending. So it's when we use those words, I am the owner of my karma, born of my karma, related to my karma, abide supported by my karma, what that's saying is that the felt sense of our life, the feeling of being this person with this personality in this place and this time, it's formed out of these patterns of experience. It's formed out of the complexity of actions that we've carried out or experiences that we've felt. It's formed from that. So in a way, it would be more accurate to say the feeling of who I am. The impression of I, in a way, the self view, is formed from our karma, our actions, and our experiences. That the perception of who and what we are is formed from that, but it shouldn't be taken to be some kind of fixed, separate identity. And so that when we use this kind of reflection, it's to be used as a way to help us to let go. It's not to create a more fixed and solid sense of I am, of me. Well, this is the real me. I am my karma, and it's unchangeable, and it's there forever. That's exactly what the Buddha's trying not to help us do, or to make us do with this teaching. But rather, I feel it's more helpful to understand this is what self-view is built from. This is the building blocks, the fabric of the self-image is created out of the experiences of our lifetime, what we have done, the where we happened to be born, the school that we went to, the friends that we had, the family that we were born into. The experiences of a lifetime are the building blocks, the fabric, the threads that our habits of self-view are woven together from. But they are not you know, who and what we are in an absolute way. They are all of those different threads that are woven together to create this felt sense, this impression of I as a woman, as a man, as old, as young, as healthy or sick, or, you know, or whatever, the particular patterns that we experience. You know, these are fundamentally to and in the most essential way to be reflected on, as these are not essentially and absolutely who and what we are. These are all anicca, dukkha, anatta. They are uncertain. They are empty. They are empty of self and what belongs to a self. They're not me. They're not mine. They're not who and what we are. And so that, but it's by recognizing those patterns that make up our personality, our personal history, our stories, and so forth, and fully accepting them as aspects of nature, exactly as they are, then by that full acceptance and recognition of them, without bias, without judgment, without confusion, then that's what helps the heart to transcend those and to see beyond that, to recognize that this is these patterns of perception, these patterns of nature that are known and felt here. These are not self. These are not who and what we are. They're not the real me. And the heart awakens to the Dhamma, or in the sense that the Dhamma awakens to its own nature. That when the heart truly knows that, is aware of that, then what's being experienced, or what's happening there, is it's the Dhamma is aware of its own nature, and that awareness then brings with it a quality of freedom, of ease, and brightness, joyfulness. So I offer these thoughts for consideration on this rainy autumn evening. And whatever is useful, please take it and use it. Whatever is not, then please leave it aside.